From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we bring you the 12th installment of our conversation with Professor Luciana Bone about the development of the economy and political structures of the Soviet Union. So, Luciana, this week we're going to talk about the tie that binds billions, as a matter of fact. That's the tie between fascism and imperialism.
Yes, that's right. Good morning, Don.
Good morning.
Nice to be here.
The same. Thank you. So let's go right in.
Okay. Just to recap a bit before we get into the imperialism side.
Very good.
I just want to... We've concentrated on Italian fascism.
Mm-hmm.
And we've concentrated on the effects of fascism on the domestic scene.
Right.
So to recap, we've said that fascism is one of two forms of bourgeois rule, that is, capitalist era rule. So we have fascism and the other is liberal democracy.
Right.
We said that fascism is a reaction to working class movements.
Right.
And the growth of revolutionary socialism.
Right.
We said that everybody, Trotsky's, Marxist, Leninists, Maoists, generally agree on the definition of fascism, which is that it is a way of restoring bourgeois rule in a nation that can no longer be run smoothly by capital under a bourgeois regular democracy.
Right.
Okay, so then also continuing to recap, we saw in Italy domestically that the attack was directed against the working class revolutions and strikes.
Right.
We saw that power concentrated in the executive, and that this absolute power banned all political parties, banned workers' union, suppressed freedom of the press, imprisoned dissidents, instituted a special tribunal to try treason and to act in defense of the state. This was all in the service of eradicating communism, but also liberal democracy. So fascism boasted that it was equally opposed to communism and liberal democracy.
Right.
So, but now it is not usually noted that from the beginning, Italian fascism had a racist component. I mean, in the Anglo-American mind, you know, popular mind, Italian fascism was a bit ridiculous, kind of, we don't hear much about, for example, its racism. If you read accounts of fascism, it just doesn't sound as awful, and it wasn't. In a certain way, as awful as Nazism, but so it's usually said that it wasn't racist, but this was not. It was racist, but it was not until very late directed at the Jewish population of Italy. So, in fact, in the early decade, that is in the 20s and much of the 30s, many Italian Jews had favored fascism,
mm-hmm.
This especially among the middle and professional classes.
Right.
And the Italian Jewish bourgeoisie had been nationalist during the period of Italian irredentismo, the 19th century national bourgeois and mass independence movement, for the unification of Italy.
This was a class position. This was a class position of that class. That trend was occurring in Italy, Germany, and other places at that point in time.
Yeah.
And
it was in the interest of the Jewish Italian bourgeoisie to put together a state and eliminate the ghettos, for example. We have to understand that's the last ghetto in Europe to come down was 1870 in Rome. Very late. So the Italian Jewish bourgeoisie had this interest in forming the Italian state. And, you know, the most decorated general in World War I was Jewish. Trieste, the Jewish mayor. I think even under Mussolini, I'm not sure of that, but certainly before.
Right.
So Jews remained untouched by fascism until 1938.
Yeah, really. At that point in time, there's a heavy German influence, and that was kind of what drove that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, that's right. Particularly after the Spanish Civil War, where there are allies, etc. So in 1938, Mussolini did pass the racial laws, and which withdrew citizenship and banned Jews from exercising professions, including teaching at university and various other radical curtailment of freedoms. But even so, Italian Jews were never surrendered to Hitler. I mean, even during the 3 years of the alliance in the Second World War, 1940-43, no Italian Jew was surrendered to German forced labor or whatever. However, after 1943, when Germany invaded Italy in September, it set up a puppet regime in northern Italy, that is, Germany did, on Lake Garda. And then about 8,000 Italian Jews were transported to the death camps and didn't return. And this was mainly in northern Italy under control of this puppet government of Salò.
Right.
Including among the 8,000 were 1,000 poor Jews who had lived in Rome in the old ghetto under the shadow and protection of the Vatican since the day of the Emperor Claudius, 2,000 years before. They were probably the most ancient continuous inhabitants in Rome, and, you know, Jewish. No, the racism of fascist Italy was anti-Slav racism. And this brings me to today, to a bit of a personal history here, or personal interest. Mm-hmm. And I know personally, because this is not in the history, in the general knowledge.
Right.
So racism was anti-Slav, and it was manifested in the very beginning. So by the Treaty of Versailles, Italy was granted the city of Trieste, which, as we know, is the most oriental, that is, eastern, northeastern city in Italy. It's right on the border of what is now Slovenia and Croatia.
Right.
So Italy was granted Trieste, and the peninsula that is right below it, and it's called Istria, which is where I was born. It's about 30 miles wide by 50 miles long. A very tiny place. These two territories, the city and the peninsula, had been a part of Austria until 1918, and they passed to Italy. But when Mussolini seized power, he initiated a policy of forced Italianization in Istria. And the majority of the population was Slavic-speaking in the interior, while along the coast, people spoke Italian from the Venetian background, to be precise. So this little peninsula was multicultural, multilingual, and the Habsburg Empire, Vienna that is, had allowed education and language, freedom of, you know, religion, whatever the groups needed. But under Mussolini, the Slavic language was banned in public places, Slavic theaters. This is mainly Croatian, but it was a peculiar language, you know, sort of a dialect. So Slavic language was banned. You couldn't speak it in public places. Slavic theaters, libraries, cultural centers were closed and sometimes burned. Education was to be Italian only. Even family names were Italianized, including on tombstones in the cemetery. Wow. So it was, so let's say your name had been Golub, it became Colombo, that is pigeon, right?
Just one more thing. Yeah.
So for example, somebody baptized Yosef became Giuseppe.
Right.
Now these people couldn't even speak Italian, you
right.
know.
Right.
And so in addition, and this was even more severe, in addition, agricultural banks were taken over by, you know, Trieste banks, Italian banks, and called in debts. And this was to force bankruptcy on farmers, to induce them to leave. And the lands were given to colonists from Italy.
Mm.
It was really a brutal campaign of ethnic cleansing, and this is 20 years between 1923 and 1943. And so the suppression of language and culture and the economic pressure to leave were the policies that I call are racist. So, in fact, the special tribunal that was instituted by Mussolini in Rome, most of the death sentences that were passed were applied to leaders of insurrections in Istria. I mean, my family was severely affected. I think my grandfather, it's a big mystery, but it probably threw the family in debt, and he committed suicide.
Mm. Yeah, it was ugly, yeah.
Yeah.
and also, the context for all of this, you know, we've been discussing the domestic policy of the fascists, in particular in Italy, up to that point, and, the extra-national, the incursions into the adjoining states, some of the things, the colonization of Albania,
yeah.
for example, and supporting civil wars in Croatia and Macedonia. Does that sound familiar, to break up Yugoslavia? But really, the anti-Slav sentiment stakes out for fascism a foreign policy whose ultimate logic is not just fighting communism at home, but fighting seat of communism, the Soviet Union. And that was its purpose, and that's what it ended up being used for.
Yes, it's a very good connection you made, which the racism leads somehow is connected to the imperialism. So you're right, and I'll get to that. Hold on a second. I just want to finish that point. The point, but just to support your point. So there was this racist ethnic cleansing kind of policy in Istria for 20 years. But as soon as war broke out in May of 1940, Italian forces invaded Yugoslavia. That is to say, the contingent, the contiguous territories of Slovenia and then down to Dalmatia. And they established, this was the occupation. They just invaded these territories, and whoever resisted in Ljubljana, for example, There were concentration camps established for Slovenians and other Slavs, and the most infamous being on the island of Rab, which I visited, beautiful island, Venetian looking, in the Adriatic. So much history here that I know too intimately and don't want to, you know.
It's okay. Share it. That's all right. The detail is not bad for people to, you know, to have, because we don't really get to focus on the ground activities in any of these places. We look at these broad strokes, or you know, the main narrative has great heroes and villains, but the actual details on the ground are usually lacking from our narrative. So don't be afraid of that. That's okay.
Thank you. The important thing is to dispel, what is the important thing? What I'm trying to do is to show that fascism does have differences, but it also has key similarities. And the racism in the service of imperialism, or, you know, living space, is always there. Even in something as ridiculous looking and sounding as Italian fascism has been made to sound.
Right.
So from the beginning, fascism in Italy was racist. It was also imperialist. And imperialism, and even the imperialism predated fascism. So it was... The imperialism started in the liberal state. So let me document this, exemplify.
Right.
Now, it is true that Libya, as a colony of Italy, it was called Italian Libya. It is true that it was established in 1934. But it was taken from the Ottoman Empire by Italy, the territories of Cyrenaica and Tripolitania. You see, these names all echo from the 2011 Libyan war.
Yeah, right.
But nobody mentioned that it had been, you know, an Italian colony in the news at that time.
Right.
So it was taken by these two territories, Cyrenaica and Tripolitania, were taken by the Kingdom of Italy, by the liberal government in 1912, after the Italo-Turkish War. So a resistance immediately took off, and it wasn't quelled until 1931. The resistance came from the Senussi political religious order, a nationalist Sunni Muslim group. Now, this group first formed under the leadership of Omar al-Mukhtar, and Omar al-Mukhtar, I want to say, Omar al-Mukhtar's figure, that is his image, was on Gaddafi's money, on Gaddafi's
right, the dinars.
Currency. He was the national hero of Libya. And when one funny thing is, when Gaddafi visited Rome, I don't know whether it was in the 90s, he showed up in full regalia, military regalia, with a picture of Omar Mukhtar.
That's right.
You know that. Go ahead, tell me.
No, on his shirt. That's right.
Omar Mukhtar on his shirt, in chains, in these white robes, because he was a Muslim scholar, in chains and surrounded by the Italian colonists. So the Libyan resistance lasted from 1912 to 1931, and the Italian forces under Rodolfo Graziani, the general, waged a horrendous pacification campaign, which, you know, they conducted acts of repression, and resistance leaders were executed or escaped into exile. There were forced migration of more than 100 Cyrenaican people. There had been, into Italian concentration camps. But after two decades of this tremendous struggle, the Italians prevailed and stayed in Libya until 1969, when Gaddafi became the head of the Libyan state.
Right. That's worth noting. Again, after World War II ended, after fascism supposedly was defeated, Italy was still allowed to occupy Libya until Gaddafi threw them out in 1969.
For how many years now?
Well, that from 1969, yeah. That's 24 years after World War II ended. That's right.
Yeah, and Rodolfo Graziani, who was called the Butcher of Libya and then was called the Butcher of Ethiopia when the Italian invaded Ethiopia. Was it 1935 or 1936? Around that, right?
Yeah, mid-30s, yeah.
Yeah. And he wasn't, Italy was occupied by the Allies, predominantly the Americans. Was he tried? He was tried sort of ineffectually sanctioned, but he was a war criminal and he was not in prison. He was free to go. And as you say, the occupation of Libya continued for 25 years.
Yep.
So that's...
Yep. I mean, when we look around the world at what happened in Korea, for example, or in Vietnam, in Korea, it's more striking. You had the Japanese had occupied Korea up to about the 38th parallel. And when the United States got an unconditional surrender from Japan, they didn't make the Japanese military retreat back to Japan. What they did was take over command of the Japanese military in the places it had occupied. And thus the ownership in a real sense of South Korea came into the United States through the conquest of that by fascist Japan. The same thing we're talking about for Libya here.
And we have the same thing in Italy, because all the fascists, the Interior Ministry was stuffed with the old police and the old fascist secret services.
Right, that's right.
Yeah.
Yep.
So now we can see that, and the fascist state pursues two goals, at least it did in this example. It controls the working class, sets it back, and it aims at geographic and spatial expansion, imperialism. So the first goal has an anti-communist ideology. Fascism has an anti-communist ideology, which is really, in our terms, it's an anti-working class ideology, would you say?
That's right.
Right?
Yep.
In our terms.
Yeah.
And the second is an imperialist goal based on, racism, which is manufactured, actually.
Right.
Right? As an excuse.
Right. This is an enabling technology, essentially. What we have, the bourgeoisie in a particular country taking control of the nation state by fascism, and then that particular bourgeoisie, that national bourgeoisie or semi-transnational bourgeoisie at the time, looking to take control. In other words, it goes to war against its own workers at home and against the other bourgeoisie abroad, and seeks to have hegemony ultimately globally as the global bourgeoisie.
Yeah, that's right. Now, in the United States, this imperialism is hidden behind freedom and democracy, and we improve the lives of this and the international community, right to protect. Right. The goal is never expressed in those crude terms. We are out to conquer the world. It can't be, right? It has to be hidden. Right. And it has to be hidden by propaganda. But in Mussolini's case, listen to what he said. He said, in the doctrine of fascism, empire is not only a territorial or military or mercantile expression. Empire is not territorial, military, mercantile expression, but a spiritual and moral one. And that's where you get the exceptionalism.
Right.
You know, they translated that into the spiritual and moral imperative. In America, it's called, we are the exceptional country, we are the indispensable country, right?
We have
a manifest destiny to improve the world. Well, and he went on. You can think of empire as a nation that directly or indirectly guides other nations without the need of even conquering a single square kilometer of territory. For fascism, the tendency to empire, that is, the expansion of the nation, is a manifestation of vitality. And he said that in 1932.
A few years before he ended up hanging upside down. He didn't, he didn't look terribly vital then, did he?
No, didn't. So,
you know, let me ask you, this is something that rolls around in my head from time to time. You have, on the one hand, you know, that point of view being expressed, and the fascists generally, you know, we're exceptional because we're stronger, purer, whatever it is. In other words, you know, we're ordained with it, you know, destined for it. And the Americans, it's more out of their good works. In other words, we're good. We want good for people. We want democracy for people. We want justice for people. We want rule of law for people. And therefore, we're exceptional. It's almost like a Catholic Protestant Reformation kind of schism in the underlying assumptions. But they're both exceptional, of course.
That's why I emphasize we're not only a territorial expression, said Mussolini, but we are a spiritual and moral one. And of course, in the American case, it comes from, we shall build a shining...
Right, a shining city on the hill. A shining city on the hill.
Yeah. So you are right. There is this idea that the shining city on the hill will spread out to the, we will spread it out to the world. And are Americans aware about how silly that sounds?
I don't know. Not enough of them talk to enough people, you know, elsewhere to have that perspective, I think. And that's, to me, that's the fundamental problem. And what's interesting to me is that at this point in our history where we're seeing people questioning the media in particular, you know, somewhat aggressive, very aggressively for Americans, the response is that communication from abroad that they're finally having needs to be shut down at all costs or else they won't be able to maintain control. And I think that we'll start there next week because we want to really develop the relationship between fascism and imperialism and take a good look at how imperialism developed, beginning with the advent of fascism, I think, in particular. So thank you very much,
Excellent.
Luciana.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We'll speak with you again next week. Thank you. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.